Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. This is episode 13, Take Me to the River, part 1. After a brief sidetrack in the last episode for graduation season, let's dive back into electricity generation. In the past few episodes, we've looked at various forms of ancient solar energy: coal, natural gas, and oil. Ancient because the energy itself comes to us from plants and animals that lived hundreds of millions of years ago. Solar, because the energy they contain came from the sun, either directly through photosynthesis by the plants or indirectly by the animals eating the plants and then other animals eating those animals, and so on. I am sorely tempted to break into the circle of life again here, but maybe I'll just plant it in your brains and let it germinate on its own. You're very welcome. Now that we've covered ancient solar energy, I want to explore a different and even more ancient form of energy, water. The basics, the compromises, and the opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy. Water itself first shows up on Earth about 4 billion years ago. And as fascinating as that origin story is, our Wayback Machine is not equipped for that big of a journey. And even if it was, we would not want to be there. Massive asteroids raining down on Earth in what scientists call the late heavy bombardment. Spectacular, but not survivable. So we'll leave that one to the imagination. But harnessing the power of water does go back a long, long way, at least from the perspective of we 21st century humans. And I'm focused here on the use of technology to harness the power of water. Outside of technology, I have to imagine that like other life forms, hominids have been using running water since basically forever. Animals, in fact, have been gathering around water since, well, animals. Water is life. Okay, Danny Rojas, football is life too, but this is a climate show. Water is also drinking, transportation, cooking, cleaning, and all sorts of other uses, back to the dawn of time. And of course, agriculture, starting about 10,000 years ago. Those will have to wait for future episodes of the podcast, however. The power of water comes from its weight, liquidity, and almost perfect incompressibility. In short, it's heavy, it flows at a wide range of ambient temperatures, and when it flows, it transfers the force of that weight very efficiently to whatever it pushes on. So we need a river, first and foremost. Add gravity, water moving from a higher place to a lower place, and you've got a massive amount of power. In the simplest terms, river plus elevation change equals power. If we can control that power through channels and dams and pipes, we can do amazing things. Workloads well beyond the strength of humans or other animals. Like I said, the animal kingdom has had that figured out, intuitively at least, since forever. As you may have guessed, though, the water power technology story begins with our old friends, the ancient Greeks and ancient Chinese, who, independent of one another, developed the water wheel about 3,000 years ago. You know, people often ask me what has made Silicon Valley special over the last decades, and it's an extraordinary place for a variety of reasons. But for me, the OI, the original innovators, were those two civilizations 3 millennia in the past. If I actually had a Wayback Machine, I might go and never come back. From the Greeks and Chinese to the Near East by at least the 4th century BC, and then to the Romans a few hundred years later. Not quite the mobile phone adoption curve, but pretty impressive by the standards of the time. The use of the water wheel was focused, as you might imagine, on agriculture. Many grains are inedible unless they are milled, and milling grain by hand is an incredibly inefficient labor-intensive task. Like the difference between a person with a shovel and a person with a caterpillar backhoe, except the end product was the food that person needed to survive. Game-changing. Not just grain, though. The Romans figured out how to convert the rotating motion of the water wheel into repetitive linear motion and use that linear motion to cut marble. The Chinese figured out how to use it to run a pump for bellows for blast furnaces. These people were not messing around, innovation-wise. Fast forward to the Islamic Golden Age, basically the 8th to the 13th centuries AD, and it's another burst of innovation. They were milling everything with water power. Grist, paper, steel, sugar, lumber, ships. And then to the 19th century, when French engineer Benoit Fourniron got to tinkering, along with many others, working to apply modern scientific and mathematical methods to the ancient water wheel. That was important. The nascent Industrial Revolution needed a lot more power than a traditional water wheel could provide. Steam, of course, would be part of that equation, but if you had flowing water, water power was a lot cheaper and safer. Enter engineer Fourniron. In 1827, at the tender age of 25, Fourniron made his first prototype. A turbine instead of a wheel, horizontal instead of vertical, with blade-covered shafts rotated by water passing by them. And as we know from our explorations of coal, gas, and oil, that rotational energy matches up quite nicely with an electromagnetic generator. Et voila, electricity. Fourniron's first turbine was quite small, as would be expected, producing about 4.5 kilowatts, equivalent to about 6 horsepower. His machines rapidly got bigger and more efficient, and speed and scale took over. Hundreds of machines were deployed over the next decade, including at the house of an English engineer named William Armstrong, who built the first private power plant in his house in Northumberland. Fourniron's design was about 80% efficient. In other words, it converted 80% of the water's kinetic energy into rotational energy. This is quite remarkable as compared to the steam engines at the time, which were only a fraction of that efficiency. And, by way of comparison, even today's best gas turbines, the best that General Electric, Siemens, Mitsubishi, and the like can make with today's rocket science level technology, is about 63%. And that's with the additional efficiency of combined cycle operation. So, as you can imagine, Fourniron's design was soon being adopted and emulated across Europe and the United States, particularly in New England's textile mills. And by the word emulated, I mean, I hope he got paid, but I doubt it. Peak Fourniron, so to speak, was probably in 1895, when a Fourniron turbine was installed at the world's first large-scale alternating current power plant. This plant, the Edward Dean Adams Power Plant in Niagara Falls, New York, came online in 1896, and part of the plant is actually still there today. It wasn't just precocious Fourniron, however. Opportunity was knocking loudly. In 1848, a British-American engineer named James Francis took the hydroelectric turbine to 90% efficiency, principally by designing turbines for specific water flow conditions of a given site. And then, in the 1870s, an American inventor named Lester Pelton developed another important iteration. Unlike a combustion turbine or an internal combustion engine, hydro turbines are exceedingly simple machines, operating under pretty consistent and benign conditions. No burning fuel inside them, for example. So, with good maintenance, they tend to last for decades and often more than a century. As a result, both Francis-type and Pelton-type turbines are still in use today around the world. Now, let's go upstream of the turbine. both figuratively and literally. How does the water get there, and with enough force to spin a turbine? Now I get to say the word dam a lot. To be clear for our younger and or more sensitive listeners, that's D-A-M and not D-A-M-N. The noun, not the verb, let alone the exclamation, adjective, or adverb. This is a podcast for the entire family, after all. Is everyone thinking of the same word? Good. So what comes to mind? North Americans are probably picturing Hoover Dam in the western U.S. South Americans, probably Itaipu, straddling Brazil and Paraguay. In Africa, Aswan in Egypt, or Cahora Bassa in Mozambique. Three Gorges in China, or Banasura Sagar in India, and so on. No matter what or where, all are giant, impressive structures with lake-like reservoirs behind them. Humans bending their will, bending nature to their will, that sort of thing. Seriously impressive, but only a small part of the dam story. In fact, there are about 90,000 dams in the U.S. alone. Of those, only a few percent actually produce power. The rest serve flood control, water supply, aquaculture, and recreational purposes. Now, it's not easy to find really accurate worldwide numbers, but estimates range around 800,000 dams. And only a fraction of those are large dams. Once you start looking for them, you start to see them pretty much everywhere it's hilly or mountainous. So what are we looking for? There are two basic types of dams. The one I mentioned, the rock stars of the dam world, are called impoundment or reservoir dams, in that they impound water behind the dams, forming reservoirs. That water is then available to run through the turbines inside the dam when power generation, irrigation water, or flood control is needed. There's an interesting nuance here, though. Take the Hoover Dam. It's a large impoundment dam with two massive reservoirs behind it, Lake Mead and Lake Powell. Mead and Powell together actually hold enough water to supply California's needs, all 39 million of us, for a full year. That's a lot of dam water behind the dam. Here's the nuance, though. Hoover is generally thought of as a hydroelectric dam, which it is, but power generation is actually subordinated to the Colorado River system's other needs, from flood control to water storage to agricultural irrigation. In other words, electricity actually comes not first, but last on the priority list. The other type of dam is a diversion dam, also called a run-of-river dam. Instead of massive earthen or concrete wall, diversion dams use purpose-built canals or pipes to take flowing water from a river, run it through turbines to capture its energy, and then return it to the river downstream. Diversion dams tend to be smaller and much less obtrusive, or, if you're a civil engineering geek like I am, magnificent, but dependent on river flow rather than stored water. That's the big difference. All of which brings up an incredibly important point. Hydroelectric power is location-specific. Unlike a fossil fuel plant, which, from an engineering perspective, can be put almost anywhere, hydro is a creature of place. We'll see the same thing with wind, solar, and other renewable energy generation. Opportunities for hydroelectric power are incredibly dependent on the natural environment. Rivers, elevation changes, appropriate geology. We humans can make huge changes to that natural environment, giant dams, for example, but unless the fundamentals are there, no hydro. We can do extraordinary things, but only with the raw material that Mother Nature provides. That said, it doesn't take much. Remember Forniron's tiny turbine 1.0? Take a close look at a creek near you. You may see a strange little arrangement of concrete and metal attached to a nearby power distribution pole. That's a dam, a hydroelectric dam. There's even conduit hydro, where microturbines attach to municipal water pipes to make a very small but meaningful amount of electricity from city water flowing downhill, from a holding tank, say, to your home, and every size in between. Once you start looking. With that background, it's time to tee up our next episode, where we'll start to parse the many pluses, minuses, and, you guessed it, compromises of hydroelectric power. Hydro's many roles in the power grid, the local politics and geopolitics, environmental and climate considerations, and the human factors. As always, with eyes wide, wide, wide open. And, as always, we'll explore the opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy in this ancient form of energy. I'll see you soon for the next episode of Climate Changes Everything. Thanks for listening.